Leaders from the book industry and the American Library Association gather next week in New York City. The Association of American Publishers has invited them to share perspectives on a growing controversy over ebook pricing for libraries. For the moment, as the diplomats might say, the dialogue is businesslike. That could change, though, if the setting shifts from a conference room to the courtroom. And Nobel Prize-winning Nigerian writer and activist Wole Soyinka sees unique potential for Africa to act as a conduit for peace at a time of global crisis. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of the news that has everyone in publishing talking. And joining me, as he regularly does on Fridays, from his New York office is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor. Hello there, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, you'll be packing your bags again very shortly, headed off to the Frankfurt Book Fair. Tell us what we can expect in Monday's issue on that subject.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's just a few short weeks, and it's back to Germany for the world's biggest book fair. And in Monday's issue, we'll have a short preview of this year's fair and a rather lengthy article from my colleague Rachel Deal, who will once again offer her popular Frankfurt Briefcase, which runs down the highlights of what agents and publishers are going to be bringing to the fair this year. You know, I don't need to tell you that sometimes these conferences and events, they can be a little, you know, exhausting, shall we say. But I really love the Frankfurt Book Fair. I've been going for a while now, and I'm really excited to get going this year. The fair team at Frankfurt has worked really hard, and they've worked really hard over the past few years to ramp up the programming. And I feel like it's really given the fair a great sort of digital forward-looking edge. They have the Story Drive conference now. They have Spark Stages, which feature short conversations right on the show floor with publishing leaders from around the world. And they have the Frankfurt Academy effort, which is like a year-round publishing, professional publishing effort. So I feel like the Frankfurt Book Fair has expanded from a place not only where you go to do some business, but also where you, you know, get a handle on new business you might be doing. And of course, they have the one-day O'Reilly Tools of Change at Frankfurt, which kicks off the day before the conference starts. And that's one of my favorite events. So bring it on. I'm excited for Frankfurt, and you can get excited for it, too, by picking up Monday's issue.
Well, it sounds like it's a show that's done well by keeping up with the times, and we'll look forward to talking to you from Frankfurt while you're there. Speaking of gatherings, though, another one is on tap for this coming week between publishers and libraries.
Yeah, that's right. As you mentioned, on Thursday, there's going to be Thursday of next week, I think that's the 27th, there's going to be an AAP-sponsored one-day event with publishers and leaders from the American Library Association. And I have to say, this is coming at a very, very tense time. You know, at the end of the previous week, we learned that Hachette would become the latest publisher to jack up its prices for ebooks to libraries. And the response this time has been really very harsh from the library community. In Monday's issue, I'm going to have a lead story on that and on the state of affairs between libraries and publishers. And this comes just a couple of weeks, after I published a feature on the sort of growing complexity in the library ebook marketplace and the increasing tension that's, you know, coming in from rank and file librarians who are kind of sick about dealing with this library ebook issue. So I'll make two observations about this. The ALA has really worked very hard to engage publishers in conversations about ebooks. But I think it's now pretty much crystal clear that publishers really have very little desire to offer libraries any kind of real access to ebooks. And I'll say that about the big six publishers. Smaller and independent publishers seem to be working quite well with libraries, but when it comes to the big six, that's not the case. You know, from a purely business perspective, they seem to be still very afraid that borrowing is going to replace buying when it comes to ebooks, even though libraries are arguing and trying to produce data that will prove persuasive that libraries actually spur sales. And this brings me to another point, which is the possibility of more aggressive action by libraries. You sort of referenced courtrooms in your introductions. And, you know, I spoke with ALA President ALA Executive Director Keith Fields earlier this year and asked him if legal action was, you know, on the horizon here. And he said no. But I get a very distinct sense now that there's going to be some sort of legal or legislative component to this issue very soon. Now, I'm not saying ALA libraries or anybody are going to file suit, etc. But I do know this. They are going to start giving this much, much higher public profile. And I do believe that, especially with all of the attention from the Department of Justice and the state's attorneys, that it's going to catch the attention of somebody, possibly of somebody in Congress. And up until now, you know, these talks have yielded nothing. In fact, they haven't yielded any progress, but they really not stopped matters from getting worse. So as ALA midwinter approaches in a few months, I think you're going to start seeing a more public face to this issue. And I would not be surprised if some public officials don't pick up on this and start getting involved.
Well, it does indeed sound serious, and nothing more serious than being in court, as several parties have been for some years now. We've got some news on a couple of cases you followed for us all along.
We do indeed. The first is in the Authors Guild versus Google matter. You know, I've taken great pains to stress over the past few podcasts how the current appeal being lodged by Google was not going to delay matters. Well, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals has decided that I'm going to be wrong on that issue. You know, Judge Chin even expressly denied Google a stay at the district level, but the parties both got together and agreed, and the Second Circuit has allowed them to put a stay on this case for the time being. That means that everything is suspended. There will be no more filings in the case, and there will certainly be no oral argument on those motions until after the Second Circuit has ruled on that appeal. So for now, the Google case is suspended indefinitely, and that could be pretty lengthy. By Judge Chin's own estimate, it could be a year, possibly more.
Well, you know, if people are disappointed to hear that, they might have to wait a year for that case. So, they have less time to wait for another very similar case.
That's right. Just because the Google case that Judge Chin is hearing has now stayed doesn't mean we're not going to have a development, because the Authors Guild case against HathiTrust, which centers on a lot of the same digitization action, is fully briefed, and that's awaiting a decision on the cross motions for a summary judgment, and that could come any day now. And barring a victory by one side or the other there, we have a trial date penciled in for November. What's notable about that is that after 7 years of litigation and all the back and forth and the settlement, etc., Judge Chin is now quite clearly not going to get the first crack at making a fair use ruling on the digitization issues here. Instead, that's going to go to Judge Harold Baer, who very likely will rule first now, given the delay in the other case. And that decision in the HathiTrust case could very much shape the outcome in the Google case. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. Suffice it to say, we're on the case here at Publishers Weekly, so you can watch the Publishers Weekly website for developments. And I'll add this, Chris, I'm sure the fates are almost going to always conspire to make my job harder, which means that decision is probably going to come while I'm in Frankfurt.
Well, round-the-clock coverage, round-the-world coverage from Andrew Albanese. And if people aren't sick of hearing about legal cases, you've still got one more. And that, of course, is the litigation that continues after the settlement in the ebook price-fixing case.
This price-fixing stuff, the settlement was approved, but this is not over. This week we saw more wrangling from Bob Cohn. And, you know, Bob Cohn is the founder of Royalty Share, and he's an attorney and he's an author himself. And I can tell you this, I had lunch with Bob this week. He's not going away. So the settlement stuff is not over. Even if it gets implemented and it gets moving along as it seems to be, hang on to your hats there. It's not over. But also, we've got the trials, and the trial stuff is for the non-settling publishers, and Apple is starting to heat up as well. And you have the consumer class action. And this week, in a very interesting filing, we learned that Amazon had filed a motion in a Washington courtroom to quash a subpoena served on them by Apple and the non-settling publishers. And that tells me, as expected, that Apple and the publishers certainly intend to put Amazon on trial here in their defense. Now, to what effect? We'll see, you know, whether or not it has any bearing on whether the publisher is engaged in some sort of legal collusion. But it's going to be really fun to watch in the coming weeks to see if Amazon's wall of silence on its ebook business comes crumbling down, whether we get a peek behind the curtain at Amazon.
Now, people have been waiting for a long time for even the possibility of that. Andrew Albanese, PW Features editor from New York, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And now we want to turn, as we do every week on Friday, for the review of the reviews. And for that, we ask Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville, to join us. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Hi, Chris.
Hello there. And what kind of books are we going to be reading about this week?
This week, we start with the fiction section. Short story master Alice Munro is back with Dear Life, her 13th collection. Munro depicts key moments without obscuring the reality of a life filled with countless other moments, told or untold. And for the first time, Munro writes about her childhood in four pieces that she describes as not quite stories. I believe they are the first and last and the closest things I have to say about my own life, she says. These feature the precision of her fiction with the added interest of revealing the development of her eye and her distance from her surroundings, both key, one suspects, in making her the writer she is. Also in William Gillespie's Keyhole Factory, a man-made plague called Pandora is deliberately unleashed upon an unsuspecting populace. Readers live through the spread of the epidemic and will be horrified as it quickly devastates mankind, causing a breakdown in law and order and communications. It plays out like a bio-warfare version of Arthur Schnitzler's La Ronde, with death substituting for sex, says the PW Review. And we think that this is the most poetic take on the apocalypse since Dennis Johnson's Fiscadoro. We also have a Q&A with Diana Wagman. Her new novel, The Care and Feeding of Exotic Pets, has a woman held captive by a man who keeps a 7-foot-long iguana named Cookie in the kitchen. And when we asked Wagman what inspired her to write about an amateur herpetologist, she said she knew the kidnapper was delusional but didn't want him to be evil. So she thought a pet, but not a dog and not a cat. The giant iguana was odd, kind of frightening, and could come from his carnival childhood.
Well, that's very intriguing indeed. And in mystery and thriller, we have the return of a classic Private Eye.
Yeah, Robert Goldsboro perfectly captures the smart aleck voice of Archie Goodwin, who is the more than Watsonian sidekick to the quintessential armchair detective in Archie Meets Nero Wolfe. This is a prequel, obviously, to Rex Stout's Nero Wolfe Mysteries, and it's set in 1923 when the 19-year-old Archie arrives in New York City, where his shooting of two would-be thieves while serving as a guard on a Manhattan dock leads to meeting his future boss. We also covered David Carnoy's The Big Exit, his second thriller after Knife Music. This book has it all: a convoluted but convincing plot, a likable protagonist facing terrible odds, and a meaty supporting cast of friends and foes. After serving 7 years for vehicular manslaughter, Richie Foreman gets out of jail to discover that his friend Mark McGregor, who he claims was actually behind the wheel in the accident, has not only achieved success as a hotshot internet entrepreneur, but also married Richie's former fiancée. So when Mark is brutally murdered, of course, evidence suggests that Richie was involved. Our Q&A and mystery this week is with James Kilgore, author of Prudence Couldn't Swim, in which a white ex-con looks into the drowning murder of his black African wife. And Kilgore, who was once involved in the Symbionese Liberation Army and was a fugitive from justice for years, talks about drawing on his own experiences as an inmate in California prisons.
In science fiction, you've got a couple of collections to tell us about, one with a distinctly Canadian sensibility.
That's right. These are both from Fairwood Press, which specializes in short story collections from writers pushing the boundaries of speculative fiction. So we've got two of their books this week. One is Flying in the Heart of the Lafayette Escadrille by James Van Pelt. This is his fourth collection, and it contains 23 examples of his deft, imaginative science fiction and fantasy. It really goes all over the map, from the dramatic to the spooky. There's some ecological disasters both on Earth and in space, and overall throughout the collection, vivid atmospheres and solid plotting make for satisfying reading. And the other is Over the Darkened Landscape by Daryl Murphy, and this is definitely a Canadian collection. I know that Americans often fall into the trap of thinking of Canada as just another state up north, but there is really such a thing as a Canadian sensibility. So, for example, one of the stories, Northwest Passage, which is probably one of the most optimistic pieces in the collection, borrows a lot from Jack London. And there are also characters like Barry's lost boys who are suddenly forced to grow up, and some talking storybook animals. And our reviewer says that Murphy's range is impressive, as is his ability to immerse readers in a variety of worlds. In romance, we cover Beth Chiodo's Her Sky Cowboy. This launches a steampunk romance series with a pretty fabulous premise. 1960s hippie activists go back in time to the late 1800s. They're hoping to prevent 20th century atrocities, but instead they end up corrupting the Victorian era with modern technology. There's also a paranormal aspect, as intermarriage between the Mods and the Vicks leads to children with unusual talents. So the first volume sets up a great romance between an airship mechanic and a sky cowboy pilot who join forces to find Leonardo da Vinci's lost ornithopter designs. And in romance, we have a Q&A with Zuri Day. In Love on the Run, her newest contemporary African-American romance, track star Shana Washington escapes an abusive relationship and then falls head over heels for her new manager, Michael Morgan. And Day says, "I love sports and enjoyed track and field during my high school years. We often see heroes as star athletes. I wanted my heroine to be one."
And in nonfiction this week, Rose, you start us off with a guide to family life that comes to us from a very special place indeed.
That's right. Community activist Michael Shelton, the author of Boy Crazy, brings intellectual rigor to family pride, what LGBT families should know about living in isolated, unwelcoming, or hostile communities. This is a really well-researched examination of the history, progress, and challenges of LGBT families in the U.S., which is a broader focus than the title implies. And Shelton seeks not only to provide a resource for families, including options for religious families whose churches reject them, questions to ask when seeking medical treatment, and so on, but also to educate a larger audience. The third book in Sherry Coons' Prefabulous series is Prefabulous, Almost Off the Grid, Your Path to Building an Energy-Independent Home. This is an attractive coffee table style book featuring 32 prefab houses that, to one extent or another, boast environmentally friendly, efficient, and renewable energy elements. Now, Coons' definition of almost off the grid, which she considers the optimal amount of energy independence, is a minimal need for energy use from the utility company, while also presenting the possibility of returning energy back to the grid. She also wants to debunk the myth that prefab houses are all double wides and ugly little boxes. In fact, the homes shown here are architect designed and stylish, running the gamut of pricing, styles, and luxury. And finally, the Nobel Prize-winning Nigerian writer and activist Wale Soyinka offers a fascinating, urgent appraisal of Africa's relationship to the world in Of Africa. With Africa functioning as a conceptual construct as much of a set of specific geopolitical, economic, or cultural realities. At a time of global crisis, Soyinka sees unique potential for Africa to act as a conduit for peace, uses the 2001 Millennium Commission report on Africa, spearheaded by Kofi Annan, as a springboard to both assess critical problems and challenges, from high-level corruption to inter-ethnic fighting, famine, disease, religious and racial violence, and post-colonial economic dependency, and also muse on a broader imperial discourse, referring to the past fictioning of Africa, that brings both the African continent and, in particular, the West into a mutual tenuous definition.
In children's, we start off with picture books.
Yeah, on the picture book side, we review Kadir Nelson's new book, I Have a Dream, which is a gorgeously illustrated interpretation of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s iconic 1963 speech. We've also got a review of the first children's book from retired NASA astronaut Mark Kelly, who many may remember as the husband of Gabrielle Giffords. His book is called Mousetronaut, and it's partially based on a true story. On one of his Endeavour flights, the research mice on board clung to the mesh of their cage, except for one that seemed to enjoy the experience of weightlessness. And for those who think that picture books can't tackle big topics, there's Infinity and Me, in which a small girl tries to grapple with the concept of infinity, with friends, family, teachers, and others giving her different ways to conceptualize it, such as an endless succession of ancestors or a noodle being cut in half again and again and again and again. On the fiction side, we have a review of Pinned. This is a really well-done romance from Sharon Flake about two black teens. One is the only female wrestler at her school who struggles academically. The other is a brilliant boy who was born without legs and has a substantial arrogant streak. We've also got a pair of mysteries featuring teens solving crimes, but they do so in realistic ways with lots of mistakes, missteps, and miscommunications along the way. One is Charlie Price's Dead Girl Moon, about three teens trying to figure out who killed a young sex worker in small, depressed Montana town. The other is Burning Blue by Paul Griffin, in which a gorgeous girl is sprayed in the face with acid at school, forcing her to reevaluate who she is. As an epileptic teenage hacker, one of her classmates tries to figure out who done it. And in nonfic, we've got an excellent biography of the Bronte sisters called The Brief Lives of Charlotte, Emily, and Anne by Catherine Reif. The book not only dives into the lives of the girls and the other members of their family, but also explores their writing. Finally, in the online annex, in Misfit, Adam Braver's latest historical reimagining, he explores Marilyn Monroe's fatal struggle to simultaneously maintain her personal identity and her public image. Through the gradual unfolding of Monroe's painful upbringing and her desire to be taken seriously in a world that values the superficial, Braver makes her tragic end freshly poignant. And on the nonfiction side, Susan J. Wolfson's and Ronald Laval's The Annotated Frankenstein, based on the 1818 version of Mary Wollstonecraft's classic, does just what a well-annotated work should do, shedding a bright light not only on the text in question, but also on its historical moment and literary forebears. And as far as I know, there's no pick of the week this week, so that's the review of the reviews.
Well, you know, if I can make my pick of the week, I think I would go with Mark Kelly's Mostronaut. I have to say that the premise there of the mouse that enjoys weightlessness is something I think children would really gravitate to. Pardon the pun. Anyway, Rose Fox, who is a PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville, thank you, as always, for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.